Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. We're tonight's entertainment.
Look at my butt. Now look at my front butt.
Wada, 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 wada.
Open the circuit to the wave motion gun. Open the circuit.
Blood receiver pressure increases.
All the ship's energy is now in the wave motion gun.
I doubt anyone here would recognize civic virtue if it reached up and bit you in the ass.
Oh, did I hurt your feelings?
Only Magneto's right. There's a war coming. You sure you're on the right side?
Hello, everybody, and welcome to a special episode of Geeksploitation Radio. This is Stephen Ronquillo's Steve's Video Store, and I have my usual co-host, my partner in crime, the light to my darkness, Mr. Carl Kafer.
Greetings, salutations, everyone.
And well, before we get to Josh Hadley, the first time I've ever heard of any compensation issues. It started with Jack Kirby and Marvel taking his work and selling the raw boards at the convention and them starting a whole mess like that. And it really hasn't gotten much better. And hello, Josh.
Hello.
You've heard of the incident, haven't you, where Kirby's lawyers had to go to conventions in the late 80s, early 90s and take away the original artwork that somehow got vanished from Marvel?
Kirby's lawyers have been fighting with Marvel for decades now over everything. And unfortunately, that's not a new story. I mean, that happened at DC. It happened at 2000
yeah.
AD. I mean, you know, the artists, when you were work for hire, the work belongs to the company, and that's part of the problem is there's not a whole hell of a lot you can do about it. I mean, Kirby finally, I think it was last year, got the compensation, you know, by actually getting the credits on the films now, but that was a long-fought battle.
And all of us know Steven Bissett, who was one of the biggest fighters in the 90s for compensation for artists' rights.
Yeah,
but
the set's really big.
Okay, go ahead. Sorry.
I was going to say, Bissett's really big on the whole creators' rights things, as he should be. And without him, without pre-crazy Frank Miller and some of the other people like that, like Neil Gaiman and Harlan Ellison and all that, creators' rights might not be where they are today. Because you had these people that were willing to say, you know what, this is wrong, and something's got to be done. Because I'm sure, like when the Constantine TV series came out a few years ago, and they didn't even tell Bissett about it. He found out about it when he saw the freaking trailer for it. He knew about the movie, but not the TV show. And he wrote a huge screed about them not even keeping the artists in the loop, or the creators in this case. And I bet DC hates every time they're like, Stephen Bissett's on the phone. I bet someone at Warner Brothers offices go, ah, shit.
Yeah. And the story about Harlan Ellison and the Terminator is just one of those beautiful stories of legend.
Well, I don't know if you've ever seen Dreams with Sharp Teeth, which is the documentary. It's also a name of a story that Harlan Ellison did. But there's a great story where where Star Trek, the people of Star Trek, called him up to do a commentary on the City at the Edge of Forever, and he basically said, "Pay me."
That was actually Babylon 5.
No. And not Babylon 5. No, this is definitely Star Trek because this is off. He's still close with Stravinsky still. But this was, you should do this just because you you're part of this. No, pay me, motherfucker.
That was his whole pay the writer thing, and that was actually Babylon 5 because he talks about how Warner Brothers owns Babylon 5, whereas Paramount owns Star Trek. He talks about how Warner Brothers is hardly out there with a steel cup begging for money.
Yeah, but you know what? You are right. You are right. It is Babylon 5. But man, you know, I love Harlan because he does not take any shit. You know, and certainly.
And this is a rarity, Carl. Usually
what?
On every one of Josh's podcasts, they call him, "You're not right, you're old, out of date." But we say he is right.
I'm used to Cecil always being wrong.
Well, don't get Steven started on Terrence Malick, okay? Just don't.
Terrence Malick's a fucking preening fruit.
But sadly, I wish it would start there, but no, it happened. It started with Fangoria when we got the proliferation of internet writers and their amazing ability to say, "I'm in Fangoria. That means I want to get exposure." That to me is the dirtiest word of the 2000s, is exposure.
Well, you know what happens when you get exposure? You die of exposure.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah.
Because in 2009, it came out that they were Fangoria doing that. It came out during the whole Leanne Spider Baby mess that most of the writers were working for exposure and for free for Fangoria. There's a difference between working for an indie mag like Pete's Grindhouse Purgatory and Wings Chop, which I write for, and something like Fangoria.
Yeah, I mean,
really
I write for Forces of
Get Paid.
I write for Forces of Geek, and I do that because it's a website I like and it's a column I like to write. A place like Fangoria can fucking pay you.
Yeah. If what to believe was true. I think from about 2008 to about 2010, every one of the so-called professional writers for Fangoria were just some fanboys. They got to write articles for free.
Pretty much. And then I didn't know Tom DeFeo at this point. That was before Tom DeFeo bought the magazine. When Tom DeFeo bought the magazine, it was pretty much a dead stick. And from what I understand is when he bought the magazine, he was a shrewd businessman and people did get paid. And, you know, when he bought it, he apparently did make good on all the people who hadn't been paid in the, you know, late, you know, 2008, 2009 era. That's not the same man that runs the magazine today, even though it's the same man.
I think the biggest case is the guy who writes Shock Cinema, Steve Potowski. He says that, I don't know if they ever paid him off because he's never really, he said he would post and say if they ever did, and he hasn't, but they owed him $3,000 for his work on the Dr. Cyclops columns.
I wouldn't be surprised about that. I mean, I'm not going to say how much I'm owed, but it is four figures. And that might not be a lot of money to some people, but it's a lot of money to me. And if Fangoria has not paid me in over a year, I had to take Thomas DeFeo personally to court. I have the judgment in my name, and he's still not paying. So now I have to spend more money I don't have to take the son of a bitch to collections, even though I have the court saying he owes me this money.
What's the use of small claims court if they can say, well, we can tell him to pay you, but we can't make him do it?
Exactly. So now I have to try and figure out how to collect the debt. And I'm still working on options for that at the time of this recording.
Yeah. What do you think about, Carl, that small claims court, Carl, it's like you told me that, go tell the guy A to pay you. And I walk up with a ball bat and said, you got to pay him. And then he's like, you're going to have to hit me first. And I go, oh, I can't do that. Then walk away.
Well, what you don't know is back when I had the music store years and years ago, we do things on credit to people. I had to go to small claims courts all the time, and it was just a waste, even back in the 80s. So yeah, it's not a really good incentive for someone to pay you, even collection agencies, things like that. It's hard getting blood out of a turnip or an asshole,
But look at it like this. From what I understand, DeFeo is attempting to sell the magazine. I know some various stories that I can't repeat of him overvaluing the magazine, but whoever buys that magazine will also be buying the debt. So
Right. If
he sells the magazine, that sale can't go through until they pay me. So in a way, it does put him in a precarious spot, is I'm not going to go away. I'm going to be like a snake with my fangs in his arm. I'm not going to go away. I'm going to be pestering him and making sure publicly anyone that tries to do business with him knows he does not pay his debts.
Well,
yeah,
there
once
you go.
You reach a certain level, you should expect to get paid for your work.
Well, see, it wasn't always like that. Back when Chris Alexander, who was the man who actually hired me at Fangoria, when he ran the magazine, I got paid. It wasn't until the whole – and this is not Michael Gingold or Ken Hanley's fault. This was a decision made above them. But after Chris Alexander left and Michael Gingold took over for a short period of time, and then Ken Hanley after that, they attempted to get all the writers paid. But Tom was like, there's no money. You got to make him wait, blah, blah, blah. So I want to be clear. Michael Gingold and Ken Hanley did nothing wrong. This is on Tom DeFeo of New York City.
Yeah, it always goes back to the top, but the people only mention bitch about people that they know.
I know for a fact I'm not the only one who's not been paid. I know that, like, for instance, what turned out to be the final issue, the Kevin Smith issue, the people that made up that beautiful cover, they haven't been paid. I know the layout artists haven't been paid. I know at least a dozen other writers throughout the last year who have written for the magazine have not gotten paid. And remember, after Ken Hanley quit and Tom DeFeo actually put out that, we love all of our fans, Fangoria will be back, blah, 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 that whole blowing smoke up your ass thing, he put in there, we are going to rectify all of our debts. And it's like, no, you're not. You're fucking running from this. I mean, hell, when I was suing him, I had to send process servers to his house. He dodged them 6 different times. They saw activity in the house. Nobody would come to the door. They saw activity in the snow. Nobody would come. He dodged my process servers. He has no intention of making good on this debt. He has no intention at all. He is running and hiding and hoping it goes away. And if he thinks I'm going away, he doesn't fucking know me.
Oh, Jesus.
That's
Josh.
Not a bad thing. I mean, if someone owes you money for work due, they should pay you. There's no gray area there. There's no area that you could fight with someone over.
See, the only problem is to take him to collections. it's going to cost me money I don't have right now. If I sue him in a larger court, that's going to cost me money I don't have. Yes, when I would win, not if, when I would win, I would get that money back. But as it stands, I don't have the money to get the money that I'm owed. That's how fucked this system is, and that's how he's playing the system. He knows all the people suing him don't have the money to sue him. So if he waits it out long enough, most of them will probably go away. I will sell my blood and semen if I have to be able to pay to keep him running.
Yeah. I mean, look at the Gorzone issue when they started reprinting that. It took 2 days for Stephen Bissette to get compensation. Probably because he knew that this guy had the money to take him to the ropes.
Well, and see, that's the thing about DeFeo. He's a bully. He's only not paying the people he knows don't have the money to take him to court. And that's what a bully does. He's not picking on the big boys. Because I guarantee you, Kevin Smith got paid for his issue. I guarantee you, Brian Fuller got paid for his issue. I guarantee when they had these big pieces on Bruce Campbell and that, those people got paid. But it's the people who don't have a name like that, that it's like, eh, what are they going to do?
Yeah. I mean, that really started with all magazines. I think you even talked about it on one of your shows once, the incident where the woman had her recipe stolen by one of the bigger cooking magazines. And she called them on it, and they basically said, "Just oh, fuck you. You should be glad that we're even printing your crap."
Yeah, exactly. And now all of us start out at that level. I started out writing for magazines just for free because when you're starting out and you don't have a name, you cannot get a paying job because you have no back catalog. So I was one of those same people I bitch about now where it's like, by giving it away, you're undervaluing the rest of us. But I was one of those too. All writers were, you know, I mean, I was lucky that when I got hired at Hustler, that was my first real big paying job, was writing for Hustler. And they just really liked my pitch. And all I had done was basically fanzine stuff at that point. And then Hustler, that's a pretty big fucking name to just – and by the way, I've never been paid as well as Hustler paid. They fucking pay amazingly.
Yeah, wow. That's one thing I've never heard a complaint about Larry Flint. Or Larry Flint Productions is that he's cheap on the writers.
No. That I've heard too. But he's very good to the writers.
Right. So it's like we all start off giving it away for free. And then we realize, wait a minute, my talent actually, my skills here, they have merit and they have value attached to them. But then you have like the Fangoria scandal of 08 where everyone just wants a byline. Now, I understand that everyone needs a byline at first. When you have no back catalog, no magazine is going to look at you. No, none. So you have to build that up. So it's kind of a catch-22. You undervalue yourself by giving it away for free, but unless you give it away for free, odds are they're not even going to look at you. You know. But then I also found out that Hustler was a double-edged sword. Having Hustler on your resume is not exactly something that impresses a lot of mainstream magazines. You know, when you're trying to write for the New York Times or Rolling Stone or something, Hustler is not really a shining moment on your resume.
Understood.
Rolling Stones. Whenever I think of Rolling Stone, I think of Steve Martin talking about when he was on the cover of it in the 80s. And Bill Murray sent him a letter that said, "Don't you wish you was on that magazine cover when it meant something?"
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I pitched stuff to Rolling Stone and, you know, never gotten a bite. At least with Hustler, if you pitch something that they don't want, they'll tell you they're not interested. Rolling Stone will just ignore you like you don't even exist.
Yeah, I've seen Mike White talking about that. He says, if it's nicer when someone doesn't want to be on your show or give you an interview, that they just say so.
Exactly. You know, it makes me think of Fatal Attraction. I won't be ignored, Rolling Stone.
Yeah. I mean, it's sad that and when I mean at a value, it's really happened a lot with all of these guys who write for websites, and you can write so much, if you don't improve what you're doing, you might not have what it takes to be a great writer.
Oh, absolutely. If you go and read some of my early stuff back when I worked for Geek Juice, that shit's fucking terrible. I mean, you know, the me of today, I looked at and go, I'd change that, move that around. God, what was I thinking with that sentence? Hey, and then I'd look at another one. What the fuck? Did you ever hear a punctuation shithead? And I would just tear it apart. And it's like, I mean, there are numerous times when I was writing the introductions back before I lost the book deal, when I was writing the introductions to collect my stuff, I was like, you know what? I'm really not sure I want all of these reprinted. Like, some of these I'd rather just let fade into obscurity, and how about I cherry pick the good ones?
Yeah. I know. That's one of the nicest things as our old radio guy, he's getting our shows on. He's like, just give me all your stuff and I'll put it on the air and report on there. I'm like, no, I am going to cherry pick through them and find the best. There's some of them I would like to take outside and burn so they don't exist.
Yeah, I've got a few pieces that I've written that I'm not too happy with. And then I have others that I'm not happy with for outside reasons. Like back when I worked for Hustler, they have a very specific style of writing, and that's not my style of writing. So while the stuff I wrote for Hustler is my work, I was writing it to conform to their style rather than my style. So I'm not happy with how some of that turned out because it doesn't sound like me.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah,
absolutely.
If you're going to be any success, you have to have your own voice.
Right. And that's one of the things, now that I work for Film Threat, that's one of the things that I have to write in Film Threat style. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, but, you know, Chris Gore was like, the style you normally write in, which, you know, was okay for Fangoria and stuff, Grindhouse Purgatory and all that, but he's like, you know, you need shorter – because remember, he comes from Hustler too. You know, Chris Gore used to work for Hustler, so – so, you know, he edits the same way that, you know, someone at LFP would. And that's not a bad thing. It's just it takes me longer to write something for Film Threat because I'm like, okay, this is the way I would write it. This is the way I need to write it.
Yeah, I never understood hiring somebody who said, I loved your work, but I want you to take your work and ignore what you do and then do it in this way. Because I want a standard unifying look.
No. I don't think that's what Gore's doing. I think Gore has always been really nice. He's always been very open. It's just, you know, he has a much more professional style than I'm used to. And that's not a bad thing at all. In effect, I think Film Threat probably will make me a better writer in the end. They're not making me conform to their style. It's I need to for myself.
I once worked for a website and did the news for them for about a year, and they were such incompetence that it broke my mind, and I stopped doing anything for 5 to 6 years. It was like, we want you to do the news because you know your stuff about obscure stuff. And then when I started really covering some more obscure stuff, well, why can't you cover Freddie and Jason? That's what I want this ad to be about.
Oh yeah, I've had things like that where I've had fights with editors. Back when I wrote for Paracinema, I had a piece on like horror hosts and stuff like that, and I had a thing on Joe Bob Briggs. The editor, she wasn't out of line, but I couldn't get her to understand that the joke I was making, which made no sense if you don't understand who Joe Bob Briggs is, You know, I was talking about how he would have all the movies with the various types of foo in it. Remember, because he would have chainsaw foo, bulldozer foo, and stuff like that. Being unfamiliar with that, that was a long, drawn-out argument for me to try and get that, the foo joke, in the final piece, because she's like, it makes no sense. I'm like, if you know who Joe Bob Briggs is, it makes total sense.
And if you have a copy of what they call the filmmaker's, the reviewer's dictionary, foo is even in there with a detailed description of what it means.
Well, see, I just grew up with, you know, Joe Bob Briggs, obviously Kung Fu, but Joe Bob Briggs fooed all of the different type of fighting things in his movies. And since I was talking about Joe Bob Briggs, it seemed to make sense to, you know, make that the joke I was. And I can't even remember if she made me change that or not. Fuck, it's been a long time since I wrote for them.
Yeah. But, yeah, I'm glad I work with Wildside Cronus and Tim Paxton, Brian Harris, and all them, because they just gave me a call and say, okay, do what you want. We like what you do.
Yeah, that's kind of like what I have at Forces of Geek. I mean, it's generally a topic-related thing. It's generally about unaired pilots, but I'm able to go off topic now and then. Stefan Blitz, my editor, he doesn't really censor me. He doesn't really tell me I can't do this or can't do that. He'll just suggest, well, like, that sentence doesn't make sense. You sure you don't want to rewrite it? I'll read it and go, you know what? You're right. It doesn't make sense. I'll rewrite it.
And we love her to death, but didn't you run into issues like that with your fellow worker on that blog you did back in the day, Carl?
Oh, No, I wouldn't say that. We just naturally argue. It's just part and parcel of the relationship. We have a co-host her name is Vicki Love, and we did a blog called X's Mark the Spot, and the reason is we're ex-husband and wife, and we always argue. So that was part of the deal, actually. That's what we want in the blog, and you know, we were thinking of doing a book at one point. So no, that was all artifice. Well, not really.
I think fighting with an editor is actually good for both parties, because you can get the editor to stop being so hard-assed, but the editor is also, they know their goddamn job, and they're trying to make you a better writer. So I actually think only one time, and this was with a Hustler editor, I was actually pissed off at the editor. And, you know, otherwise, I've never had an editor that has actually kind of pissed me off where I was like, you know, no, goddammit, you're wrong. And that the only one I've ever had was somebody at Hustler.
Well, besides those idiots at the website who were sort of amateurish, that they didn't know what in the heck they were doing, I've never really gotten into a fight. Or, Carl, does that heated discussions I used to have with our old producer on this show sort of count?
No, I'd say they sort of count because there were issues there. No,
yeah,
I would count those. Now, that doesn't mean we still don't love the guy. We still love Keith, but there were issues. It was all technical.
But you also got to look at like back in the early 70s, late 60s, when Hunter Thompson wrote for Rolling Stone. You know, I mean, he would get into fist fights with the editors.
Oh, absolutely. I'm a huge Hunter S. Thompson fan, and I know the stories like crazy. But him and Jan Winter went at it like two prize fighters. And of course, Jan Winter lost most of the time, because who the hell can you defend against
HFP? Except the thing is, if you've ever read any of Hunter Thompson's stuff pre-editing, he needs an editor.
Oh, yeah. I don't say he doesn't need an editor. I think he even would agree with that. I mean, when they finally put out the Rum Diaries, from what I understand, it had been edited three or four times and then post, you know, not posthumous, but when did that come out? 2004 or something like that. You could tell that it had been, you know, that it was rough. It was early in his career.
Well, from what I understand, for with Jan Winter was when it came to Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, that basically what Thompson sent was an incoherent mess. That, I mean, Thompson doesn't dispute this, so that Winter had to kind of make into something cohesive.
Yeah, and that doesn't surprise me either.
It's the same thing with Burroughs. You know, Naked Lunch was essentially written, you know, it's essentially just a series of vignettes, but when he wrote that, it was the editor's job to go, okay, now how do I make this mildly coherent?
In a case like Burroughs, though, I would say coherency was not his point. I think incoherency was his point, because it's supposed to be the mind on drugs, more or less, or the mind unleashed, I guess, is the way that Burroughs would put it.
Yeah.
Yeah, but when you've got talking assholes, you need some coherency.
Yeah, I'm not saying you can.
I said this again. If a movie stands out, or a book or music stands out, is that it was made for us, a.k.a. the offbeat crowd, that really means that it's not going to sell to the mainstream.
God, that's true. Anything I like,
but you
never
also have you also have this weird thing where certain writers think they don't need an editor and they think they're fantastic on their own. For instance, in the early 90s when Image first started, it was an early Youngblood issue, and Rob Liefeld literally laid out all the pages, this was at a comic convention, on a table and said it was so well written you could put you could read the panels in any order and it still made sense. And as Harlan Ellison put it, no, that means it's not well written if you can read them in any order.
Yeah. In the worst case for an editor, I would definitely put Stephen King's it to maybe the mid-90s books.
I don't know. I kind of gave up on Stephen King after a while.
Yeah. They said, oh, we're going to make an accurate version of it. And then it says, it's just going to be about the kids. There's no way to really make a movie that's basically a rambling history of an entire town and make it into under 6 hours.
Well, they tried something like that with the Talisman, where TNT was going to make it into like a 6-hour miniseries. This is like early 2000s. And the budget was like $10 million. And if you ever read The Talisman, there's no way you can do that. They shot 15 minutes of usable footage and used the entire budget.
Well, look at the Dark Tower.
And this was supposed to be a 6-hour miniseries.
Yeah. Look at the Dark Tower and what Ron Howard was going to try to do. I don't know if that would have worked.
Sometimes you just need money.
Yeah. Well, he was going to do a TV show, movies, and a couple of miniseries so he could try to stick everything in.
But sometimes stuff like that gets bloated. Like, have you ever seen the 80 or 81, like, I think it's maybe a 4-hour miniseries, the BBC's Day of the Triffids?
Yeah. Actually,
haven't you, Carl? Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I have.
Boring as fuck, isn't it?
Okay, I'm the weird one. I like it.
but there is
too much padding.
Yeah, this doesn't need to be 4 fucking hours long is when you watch it. You're like, oh, my God, you could have cut an hour and a half out of this and not lost anything.
The worst for me for padding is Peter Jackson's King Kong. I came in the movie. I wasn't feeling that good, and I fell asleep right when Jack Black first showed up. And I woke up, and I looked at my clock, watching it was 50 minutes, and they were just getting to the island.
Well, Peter Jackson is the king of self-indulgence. He just loves doing that stuff for the sake of doing it. And if New Line's willing to dump all the money at him, well, all the better.
Yeah, but still, that is way too much padding. I mean, look at the New Kong. It took, like, not even 15 minutes for them to get to the island.
I thought Skull Island was a fantastic movie. I loved that one.
Yeah, I mean, there was no padding. It was like, okay, we got a crew. The crew goes to the island. Then Kong shows up.
Yeah.
Yeah, that one was good.
I noticed that a lot
so.
With comic book movies today, too. They try to take a small, thin comic book type's arc and turn it into Gone with the Wind.
Well, I kind of felt like that with Logan. I felt like everyone was telling me Logan is so good. And the guy at the comic book store even told me if this wasn't a comic book movie, this would be nominated for Oscars. I went and saw the movie and went, did we see a different film? The film I saw was bloated and pretentious and self-important and frankly dull.
Well, I like
yeah,
it. I can see your points because there is a bit of slow drag in the middle. It's what I call Terminator 2 syndrome. Where
oh, please, don't get me started with him.
Well, no, that's just you had the T-1000, 40 minutes, intense action. And then for the next 40 or so minutes, he's not even on screen. He's not even an issue.
I actually think Terminator 2 is one of the finest action films of the 1990s, but...
No, there's no but. You can think what you want. But I'm just saying that how can you go supposed to have a tight action film when the villain just completely disappears from the plot for 40 minutes?
Well, you know, take a look at the John Wick movies. The
now,
John Wick
I was
movies,
just going to go there. It's funny. I was just
yeah.
going to go there. You go first, John.
Yeah, the John Wick movies have this strange thing where, I mean, really, there isn't a villain so much, especially in the first film, as it's just John Wick trying to get to the villain.
Right.
You know, it's just
yeah,
him mowing down faceless goons for an hour before he actually meets up with the main guys, and it's amazing.
The wonderful
I like
thing,
the
there, was
John Wick
article,
universe,
there was an article
more
on,
than John Wick himself.
Okay, Steven, go first.
No, that's just what I said. I like the universe. I think the universe is more interesting than John Wick himself.
Okay, so there was an article that I posted on my board. It's a great article. And what it said is that John Wick is the perfect action movie. And the reason for that is that everything is compact. That the first 10 minutes, you get why he's pissed. And then he just goes after people. And it's also the universe is involved. But it's the kinetic action that takes throughout the whole movie. Another movie
it
like that.
It doesn't waste any time.
No, it doesn't waste any time at all. That's the point. It just goes
except
right to the
what's so perfect about John Wick is it doesn't waste any time, but it doesn't feel like it's skipping anything either.
No. No. And The Raid is like that, and I would also say Dredd is like that. I think they
I would
are
agree
three
on both
of
those.
What?
I said I would agree on both of those.
Yeah. I love that sense where everything is pared down and you get to the meat of it and you get to the fight and you get to the action. And yet, all those characters, all those people, you have emotional contact with. And so you care about them. It's not just action for action's sake. There's something at the
core, which is where I think the Raid 2 fell a little. I liked Raid 2, but I didn't like it as much. I think it was more drug out, and it was definitely more padded, and the fights just kept going on and on and on. And I think that's where the Raid 2 fell down, where the Raid 2 was held up so properly.
Mm-hmm.
And plus, the Raid 2 is not a sequel to the Raid. It's the film he originally wanted to make, but he couldn't get the budget for it, so he went and made the Raid.
Well, you know, like I said, I didn't like the second one as much. I thought the first one was absolutely fantastic.
It's a subgenre I call ass-kicking ensues. It's really what you need. It's like bad guy does something to good guy, ass-kicking ensues. That's really all the plot you need.
Well, but then you have other movies where there is just way too much plot getting in the way of the story. Like I really enjoyed Man with the Iron Fists, but there was, what, 8, 9 different subplots going on all at the same time? For a movie like this, that's way too many.
Especially if you've seen the long cut of it.
I saw whatever cut was on DVD, so I don't know what that was.
A 90-minute cut and a nearly 2-hour cut.
I don't remember what the runtime was. I just rented it from Family Video.
Yeah. But still, the 90-minute cut is pretty fun. Yeah, you can get tangled up in too many subplots. That was the biggest reason I hated the Avengers 2. There were so many subplots that the main plot wasn't even there.
Well, what you have is like what Joe Bob Briggs used to say. Like when he reviewed Above the Law, he liked Above the Law, but he said there's way too much plot getting in the way of the story.
Yeah.
Good old John Bloom.
Mm-hmm. He's a really nice guy.
That's another one I'm jealous of you that you scored.
Well, just today, Cecil and I talked to Richard Stanley for an hour, and he was fantastic.
Okay, we now officially are envious and hate you. Please take that in the best. I love Richard Stanley. I freaking love Stanley and his work.
He was really open, and you know the interview won't be up for a couple more weeks when we do that episode. But you know Richard Stanley, I mean, honestly, I've gotten some interviews that I can't believe I got. Like Joe Dante, I talked to Joe Dante, and it's like he was so freaking nice. You know Fred Decker only had one caveat, and it was a very fair one. As long as we don't spend the whole hour talking or bashing RoboCop 3. Like, that's fair.
Oh, I would never understood why would you get someone with that level of name and put them on for an hour or 2 hours like we do and then just focus on one tiny little aspect of anything they do.
Well, okay.
That's sort of an insult to the guest, and you're insulting yourself.
But sometimes that's all they want to talk about. For instance,
yeah.
You know, I know Mike White's run into this a lot, but like when Mike White and I interviewed Lance Henriksen, we were doing it specifically about the film The Visitor, the 1979 batshit insane Avadaito Asinaitis
film.
Love
that movie.
Seen it
and
on the big screen.
Lance, you know, I'd already read Lance's book, so I knew he wasn't, you know, very fond of this film. And Mike and I were both like, and we said this, we left it in the interview, we don't know if you're going to hang up on us, but we want to talk to you about The Visitor. And then he, having a great sense of humor, goes, I refuse to talk about that movie. And he goes, nah, just kidding. And then he tells us stories about it. You know, so there are certain movies or projects where you don't want to bring up. Like, if I ever got to talk to, I almost wanted to say Rosario Dawson, but Rose McGowan. If I ever got to talk to Rose McGowan, you don't bring up how she was almost Barbarella. Because if you know the details, you know how that's such a sore spot. It's like, yeah, there are certain times where you go, I understand if you don't want to talk about this part. When, before I do any interview with the famous person, I always say, is there anything you don't want me to ask you? But I think that's just being courteous.
Yeah.
No.
The one interview that I've got for this show that really shocked me was getting Brian Usna.
I've never spoken to Brian Usna, but I've seen him in interviews, and he always seems like he's a nice guy.
Oh, he's a nice guy, but if he thinks that you're a poser and haven't seen the movies that you're talking about, he'll come down hard on you, won't he? Carl.
Yeah, I was working on doing a show on, I think at that point it was 1971 or 72, and I said that, well, I hope you see the movies that you talk about. Like, God damn it. That's my fucking dickie. Of course I've seen them. You know, on the other end, we had Stephen Lack on, and I had contacted Stephen, and he was always worried that we would only talk about one thing, which was Scanners. And like, no. We want to talk about your painting and the other things you do. And I had to work on him for quite a bit before we got him on, but I was pleased with that show too. But sometimes it goes the other way. Sometimes they don't want to talk
like,
about the one thing.
Yeah, like just today when we were talking to Richard Stanley, you know, when I asked, do you not want to talk about? And he's like, can we only spend a little bit of time on Dr. Moreau? Because he's like, you know, ever since Lost Soul came out, he's like, all I've been asked about is Dr. Moreau. Totally fair, you know, totally fair qualifier there. You know, let's concentrate on the other things and not Dr. Moreau.
By the way, I have to ask something. Did you mention the Theater Bazaar in his section on that?
Yep. We talk about Theater Bazaar. We talk about Sea of Perdition, Dust Devil,
nice.
Hardware. We talk about the music videos, you know, Fields of the Nephilim and the John Lydon stuff. And, yeah, we talk about pretty much his entire career. We do talk about Moreau a little bit. And Moreau is still a sore spot for him. At one point, we asked him if he ever even saw the Frankenheimer cut, and he said, unfortunately, yes.
Oh, I walked out of theater during that cut, and it led to one of my best movie-going stories ever. It was a scene when Kilmer was doing the Brando imitation. He said, all you need to do is hunt and fuck. So I stood up and yelled in the theater, yeah, I'm going to hunt for the door so I can get the fuck out of here. And five people followed me out.
I've never been one to really talk to the movie screen, but when I saw Star Trek VI in the theater, whatever year that was, remember at the beginning of that, the Klingon moon Apraxis explodes.
Right.
And there must have been, I don't know this person, but a couple of rows ahead of me, the moon explodes. Like I said, this is like the first 5 or 10 minutes. And he just jumps up, yeah, kick some Klingon ass! And I'm like, oh, Jesus. I'm going to have to spend the whole movie with you, aren't I? It's like, you know what? I'm a Star Trek fan. But, you know, put it back in your pants, dude.
Oh, Jesus.
I've never done anything that stupid. But I've seen people like that. They were, like, yelling like Rocky IV when Rocky starts beating on Drago. They were like, five or six guys in the audience just start going, USA! USA!
People are weird when they go to the theater. I usually just sit back and watch the movie. I mean, maybe, you know, if I'm with my girlfriend, I'll snark to her a little bit. You know, if something stupid's happening, I'll make a snarky comment to her. But I'm not going to yell it out like I'm Tom fucking Servo.
Well, you know what? I've done it. And only on a couple of occasions. But the one that I did was the remake of Willard that Clive Morgan did. And Crispin Glover is feeding the rats some cashews, and they turn the label around, and it's numb. And I just went for a second, oh my God, it's numb nuts. And everyone in the audience laughed. I was the one who got the joke. So
the only time I've yelled out in a theater, I was the only one there. Other than I went with a friend to see Battlefield Earth, and we were the only people in the movie theater.
Oh, good God.
So I felt okay doing it there.
That was.
Yes, I was one of the 12 people who paid money to see that movie theatrically.
Okay, you get a special spot in heaven for that.
I didn't say I liked it. I just said I saw it.
No. No, just to survive and go to a theater and pay for that, you get a special spot in heaven.
Hey, when I saw Solaris, I was the only one in the theater, and I fucking fell asleep. I'm talking about the Steven Soderbergh one, not the original. That movie was so boring. That's the only time I've ever fallen asleep in a movie theater.
By the way, not that it's as good as Solaris, which is my favorite sci-fi, but I actually do like the Soderbergh a lot.
It's not necessarily a bad film. I saw it again when it came to video, but talk about a fucking slow movie that needed an editor. You know, the editor in me was watching that and going, I could cut a half hour out of this film without missing a damn thing.
It's only, 96 minutes long? It's not that long of a movie.
It fucking feels like a three-hour long movie.
I know. Of course, the other one is a three-hour long movie.
And you would think compressing the story would make it flow faster, but it doesn't. I mean, like 2001 A Space Odyssey, the most boring fucking pretentious film I've ever seen in my life. I mean, I thought The English Patient was bad, but then after rewatching 2001 a few years ago, I'm like, what the, when? We're 28 minutes into the film and literally nothing has happened yet.
Well, you got to remember, Warner Brothers sent it in the bud, but on the midnight circuit in 1970, they basically played, it was a double feature of Fantasia and the last 20 minutes of 2001.
Well,
it was billed as
this.
The only part you care about.
But think about this. 2001 was actually more boring at first. In 1968, when it came out, it was 17 minutes longer. And they cut 17
true.
Minutes out that have never been seen since the first 2 weeks of its 1968 run. So that was 17 more fucking minutes of boredom.
Yeah, and just think about it. Most of the people that went to see it in the 70s were people who were getting stoned on weed to make sure that they got a big trip during the last show at the end of the movie.
I would be one of those. In fact, I scheduled it at my college. Absolutely.
Do you remember when the sequel came out in 1984?
Yeah.
The sequel,
yeah,
I think 2010 is amazing. Oh, 2010 is fantastic. And the biggest complaint was, oh, it's not as slow and ponderous as the first film. Yeah, because things actually fucking happen in 2010.
And it has Helen
Mirren. I like
Mirren,
the movie a lot
so
better than the book. The book is so happy, happy, joy, joy, it makes me want to puke.
Yeah, you know what? I don't know if they'll ever get around to making... I've heard that alternately that they were going to make 2064 and 3001. I don't know if those will ever happen, but... with today's filmmaking sensibilities, I don't think they should.
Yeah, very true.
Sometimes
so
you've waited too
about,
long and you just need to leave it alone.
So
like Independence
about science
Day?
Fiction films. Never mind. I'll quit. Go ahead.
No, I said like Independence Day. Wow. They wait so long to do a sequel, and why bother after that long?
I guess they thought the IP still had life in it.
Now, is there a particular science fiction film or film in general that you feel is underappreciated and that either could use a remake or a sequel to?
I'm not sure about a remake or a sequel, but I did a whole show on, I want to see the movie after the movie. You know, I want to see what happens after, because usually when the heroes, you know, defeat the villain or take down the alien spacecraft, it's like, you still realize they blew up 56 American cities. The entire economy is in a wreck. There's now, you know, cosmic soot creating an artificial ice age and, you know, darkness throughout the entire planet. It's like, I want that movie. I want to see what happens after that. Like, okay, think about Soylent Green. Once people know Soylent Green is people, that's going to create a ripple effect through the overpopulated world. That, to me, is more interesting than finding out Soylent Green is people.
Yeah. Well, it has an alternate ending to Soylent Green where it has, what's his name, the star, Heston, in on the journey going, yeah, going on court going, Soylent Green is people, Soylent Green is people. And then it has someone looks at him and goes, who cares?
Yeah, you know, sometimes, you know, what happens after the movie is more interesting. For instance, like Videodrome. Okay, the Videodrome signal has won. Essentially, when he blows his brains out and the TV explodes and everything, the good guys lost. The Videodrome signal is now getting out there and being distributed. Especially in the age of, like, you know, when the cable started to take over, what would that mean?
Not a virtual reality game.
You know, no, Exxtends is not a sequel to Videodrome. I've heard people try and claim that it is, and it's not.
Haven't you heard that they are thinking in the planning stages of doing a Videodrome reboot, and it's going to be a virtual reality game?
They've been trying to make a reboot of that since the early 2000s. It's never going to happen because I think, first of all, it can't. You know, just logically, because if you change Videodrome to the internet, it just doesn't work any longer. You can't do that. Like,
Okay, go ahead.
See, I came up with an idea that I want to make into a film. It's called After the Blade. What happens after a slasher movie? You know, how does the media handle a slasher movie? You know, looking at like hard copy and stuff like that. How are they going to handle the killer's family? Are, you know, there's going to be book deals handed out. The survivors, how do you handle the PTSD? What about all the cleanup? What about all the legalities where the cop shot this serial killer or, you know, the madman or something without probable cause? I want to see what happens after a slasher movie.
Yeah, and that's why I like the early 90s, the first season of War of the Worlds, the TV show, so much.
The
1988
series?
Yeah. The early 90s.
I actually like the second season of that better myself, but that I know I'm in the minority there.
But still, that was a nice way to do it, making an actual what happened after the story rather than just a sequel.
Well, my vote on it would be, without a doubt, I want to see what happens after Phase 4. I want Phase 5. I've wanted Phase 5 ever since that fucking movie came out.
Phase 5, I was going to say, if you've ever seen Jason X, the little nanite creatures, that's Phase 5. The ants got cybernetic, man.
Yeah. And since it's 1 hour to close it out, Josh, what do you think of really the fallout that's happened the last 5 or 6 months? Rue Morgue is barely putting the issues out. Video Watchdog died. Famous Monsters of Filmland died. Fangoria pretty much died. They're trying to say it's still alive, but
the fallout would be...
You think the era of the Big Time Horror Magazine is pretty much over?
No, absolutely not. because there are people like myself who will always collect it. They're one of the things that cuts magazines' throats, and they don't seem to understand, is they put the same content in the magazine that they put on their websites. And they don't seem to understand, if I get it for free, why should I pay for it? That's one thing where Hustler is very smart. The articles, and no matter what you think of Hustler, they have fantastic articles. They don't put online. They're not on the website. You have to buy the magazine for it. And I think that's what needs to be done. They need to realize magazines are magazines, websites are websites. You can have both, but they have to be separate entities. Because one of the biggest things is they think they need to be fancy now. You know, they got to have that slick, glossy paper that costs a bunch. The cover prices are the biggest turnoff for people buying a magazine. I mean, Fangoria, when they were still in print, were $10.99 a fucking issue. That's ridiculous. If you got rid of that glossy, thick paper and went back to newsprint for, you know, the bulk of the stuff, and maybe, you know, have the glossy paper for the pages that needed it, you could have gotten the cover price down to $6. I mean, Horror Hound uses very similar paper to that, and they're only $6.99 an issue. That's fucking reasonable. Fangoria and that, these magazines were not reasonable. $10 an issue is fucking ridiculous.
Well, look, well, I'll write for a Wings Chop, and it's not, and it's nine, usually about $9, $10, $12 an issue, but it's like 300 pages.
It's like buying a book.
And Grindhouse, it's about $8 or $9, right?
I think Grindhouse is like $6 to $8, depending on the different thickness.
Yeah, and it's still wall-to-wall content. There's no ads, there's no fluff, there's no filler. It's just content.
Yeah.
And with those, you got two magazines that let the writers do what they want. So you're going to get a unique experience reading the magazine.
You are, because there is also a difference between corporate and independent magazines, but that's a whole different topic. And I've worked for both, and there are very different experiences.
Well, thank you for being on, Josh. I hope you run this guy into the ground and get every cent you deserve from him.
Oh, like I said, I'm not going away. I'm going to be his herpes. Until he comes across with a topical solution. I'm going to keep flaring up every time he thinks I've gone away.
I may steal that,
if you're looking
okay.
for some of the best podcasts on here, online, go to www.1201beyond.com.
Appreciate it. It's nice that you can lie like that.
Hi, what do you mean? I've been listening to Radio Drone for since your about 20th episode.
Way back in the Brad years.
Yeah. And also, he's on, what is it, Mr. Lobo Station, we had him on here too, that you're
OSI
on now with your
old show. Yeah. OSI 74, I do the 1201 Beyond show, which is a blatant Night Flight homage.
Nice.
Oh, don't worry, this is a show, we did a two-hour show on Night Flight, so... We can say
well, I also work for Night Flight as well. I work for nightflight.com occasionally too, so I write for them too.
Yeah. God, that's I missed that show. And with that, we'll say, well, tomorrow we'll be on. Me and Carl will be doing a live watch of Robert Altman's The Long Goodbye.
The best film of 1973, my all-time favorite film, period.
And Saturday we'll have Donna herself in her show with her and Doc. And Sunday, I don't know what we're going to do yet, but we are going to do something. And with that, say goodnight, Carl. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Good night, everybody.
That's it, man. Game over, man. It's game over.
Ha, 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 ha circuit.
Blood chamber pressure increases. It's at full.
All the ship's energy is now in the wave motion gun.
I doubt anyone here would recognize civic virtue if it reached up and bit you in the ass.
Oh, did I hurt your feelings?
The Magneto's right. There's a war coming.
Danger, Will Robinson, danger.
You sure you're on the right side?
Hasta la vista, baby.